Chapter 24. As Dirk carefully guided the small ROV back to the Starfish, he began whistling the old Stephen Foster standard, Swanee River. Summer looked at her brother with abashed curiosity. "You seem awfully happy, given that the biological bombs are missing in action," she said. "Sister, we may not know where they are, but we sure know where they ain't. Now, if it was me, I'd want to keep those eggs close to the hen." Summer took a second to digest the comments, then her face brightened slightly. "The deck hangar? Where the aircraft are stored?" "The deck hangar," Dirk replied. "And the Swordfish was even kind enough to leave the door open for us." Once Snoopy was secure in its cradle, Dirk activated the main thrusters, and the Starfish shot off down the deck of the submarine towards the second torpedo blast. The detonation hole was easily large enough to allow the Starfish to drop into the interior, but the 11.5-foot diameter of the hangar was just fractionally too tight to allow any room for the submersible to maneuver any further. Dirk studied the gash in the aircraft hangar before inching the Starfish into the opening. The deck had been blasted away in pockmarked sections, leaving step-through holes that led into the dank bowels of the submarine. Dirk slowly guided the Starfish lower until he spied firm decking near the forward edge of the gap that was large enough to support the submersible. Out of the corner of his eye, he noticed that the airplane propeller they detected earlier was hanging just to his right. He gently eased lower until the Starfish's supporting skids tapped onto solid decking. As he powered off the Starfish's thrusters, a momentary silence filled the submersible. Together, they peered down the enclosed hangar that stretched in front of them like an endless tunnel. Then the quiet was broken by a muffled metallic clunk that rang through the water. "Dirk, the propeller!" Summer shouted, pointing out the bubble window towards the right. The mounting bracket that held the spare three-bladed Ceron bomber propeller had long ago corroded in the salt water, yet against all reason had somehow maintained sufficient integrity to hold the heavy blade onto the wall for 60 years. Not until the stirred waters from the Starfish's thrusters blasted against it did it decide to give up its mission and crumble from the wall in a rusty glob of dust. As the bracket fell away, the heavy propeller dropped straight to the deck, landing on the tips of its lower two blades with a clang. But the show wasn't over. They watched in helpless fascination as the propeller fell forward, its upper blade skimming just in front of the Starfish's bubble window, inches from Summer's face. It appeared to move in slow motion as the force of the water suspended the movement of the steel blades. A secondary clang echoed through the water as the blade and nose piece hit home, the entire assembly dragging across the submersible's right robotic arm and falling onto the front skid plates. A cloud of brown sediment rose and obscured their vision for a moment, then as the water cleared, Summer noticed a small trail of dark fluid rising up in front of them, as if the Starfish was bleeding. "We're pinned," Summer gasped, eyeing the heavy propeller lying across the front skids. "Try the right arm. See if you can lift the blade up, and I'll try and back us out," Dirk directed as he powered up the thrusters. Summer grasped the joystick and toggled it back to raise the arm. The metallic appendage began to rise briefly, then fell away limp. She repeatedly toggled the joystick control back and forth, but there was no response. "No good," she said calmly. "The blade must have cut the hydraulics. The right arm is as good as amputated." "That must have been the fluid we saw." "Try the left arm," Dirk replied. Summer configured a second joystick and applied power to the submersible's left mechanical arm. Working the controls, she tried stretching the arm across the viewing window and down to the fallen propeller. Since the left arm was both smaller and shorter than the right arm, it allowed for less maneuverability. After several minutes of bending and twisting the arm in various configurations, she finally worked the claw to a position where she could grab the edge of the propeller blade. "I've got a grip, but it's at an awkward angle. I don't think I'll be able to exert enough pressure," she said. Pushing at the controls, her words fell true. The arm attempted to pull the propeller up, but nothing budged. Several further attempts met with the same result. "Guess we'll have to barge our way out," Dirk replied, gritting his teeth. Applying full throttle power to the thrusters, he tried to elevate the starfish and slip back and away from the fallen propeller. The electronic thrusters hummed and vibrated violently as they clawed at the water with all their might, but the weight of the propeller was just too great. The submersible sat still as a rock while its thrusters beat the water madly, kicking up a dirty cloud of silt around them. He adjusted the thrusters forward and backward, trying to rock their way out, but it was no use. After several fruitless attempts, Dirk shut off the thrusters and waited for the brown cloud to settle. "We'll just needlessly burn up our batteries if we continue to try and slide out," he said dejectedly. "We just don't have enough thrust to pull ourselves away from the prop." Summer could see the wheels churning in her brother's head. It wasn't the first time she had been trapped underwater with Dirk, and she felt reassurance knowing that he was with her. Just months before, they had nearly died together off Navidad Bank when their undersea research habitat had rolled into a crevice from the force of a killer hurricane. Only the last-second arrival by her father and Al Giordino had saved them from a slow death by asphyxiation. But this time, her father and Giordino were 1,000 miles away. Out of the murky darkness, voices of the past began to whisper. The long-dead crew of the I-411 seemed to call out to Dirk and Summer to join them in a cold, watery grave 1,000 feet beneath the sea. The silent black sub exuded a morbid sense that sent a shiver up Summer's spine. The stirred waters around them calmed, and they could peer again into the depths of the hangar. She could not help but dwell on the fact they were lodged in an iron tomb for dozens of brave Imperial Navy sailors. Forcing the macabre image from her mind, she tried to refocus her attention on the logical demands of their situation. "How much time do we have left?" Summer asked, the desperation of their situation beginning to sink in. Dirk glanced at a row of gauges to his side. "We're fine until the scrubbers give way to the loss of battery power. It'll be lights out in about 3 hours, then another hour or so for the air to go. We better contact the Sea Rover." His voice was muted, but matter-of-fact. Summer activated the communication system and called Ryan on the Sea Rover, but was met with silence in return. After several additional attempts, the receiver crackled in her earpiece. "Starfish, this is Sea Rover. We do not copy. Please repeat. Over," came a faint and fuzzy call from Ryan. "Our comm signal must be blocked by the submarine's bulkheads," Dirk said. "We can hear them, but they can't hear us. I'll keep trying in case they can pick up sporadic signals." Summer continued calling for another 10 minutes, speaking in a loud, clear voice, but received only the same frustrating reply from Ryan. "It's no use. They can't hear us. We're on our own," Summer finally conceded. Dirk began flipping switches on the console, shutting down all non-essential electronics in order to conserve battery power. His hand came to the controls that powered Snoopy, and he hesitated. "Any objection to taking Snoopy for a walk?" "We came here to explore the hangar, so we might as well finish the job. We still need to determine if the biological weapons are aboard, or if there's any evidence they've been removed." "My thoughts exactly," Dirk said as he powered up the tiny ROV. Grasping the controls, he worked the vehicle out of its cradle and over the fallen propeller, then elevated it to eye level in front of the starfish. Ahead lay the long, dark shaft of the hangar stretching into the gloom towards the conning tower. He quickly toggled the ROV's thrusters forward, and Snoopy sailed into the darkened hangar. Both their eyes shifted from observing the illuminated ROV out the viewing bubble to watching Snoopy's field of vision on the color monitor as it moved away from the submersible. The hangar appeared empty at first, but as Snoopy moved forward, silt-covered objects began to materialize. The camera lens glided up to a large, encrusted mound positioned on a platform to one side, beyond which several large cabinets protruded from the hangar walls. "A spare aircraft engine," Dirk remarked as he aimed Snoopy's eyes at the long metal block. "I'll bet those are storage bins for other spare parts and mechanics tools," Summer added, pointing at the image of the cabinets. "No doubt there's a floor jack in there somewhere," Dirk lamented, knowing there was no way of retrieving any tools that might aid their escape. Slowly, he led Snoopy down the cavernous hangar before nearly driving the ROV into a grouping of thin metal sheets hanging vertically. Backing up the camera, Dirk identified the structure as the tail assembly of an airplane, with the tip of the vertical stabilizer folded down, as well as both horizontal stabilizers. Swinging Snoopy ahead and to the side, they could clearly see it was part of the fuselage of an Aichi M6A1 Ceyron floatplane. "Wow," Summer murmured, impressed by both the size and condition of the twin-seat bomber. "Hard to believe they could fold up a plane and slide it in here." Dirk led Snoopy alongside the fuselage for a side view of the craft. The camera showed that the wings were still attached to the fuselage, but folded back towards the tail like the wings on a duck. Faintly visible beneath the silt, they could still make out the familiar red Japanese meatball insignia painted on the wingtips. "It's still amazing to me that they could store, launch, and retrieve aircraft from a submarine," Summer pondered. "Just roll the fuselage out onto the forward deck, raise the tail stabilizers, bolt on the wings and floats, and launch it off the catapult. A trained crew of 4 men were capable of assembling and launching a plane in under 30 minutes. "I guess it's a good thing these big Sentoku boats weren't around earlier in the war," Summer replied. Dirk kept Snoopy nosing forward through the hangar. Gliding past the fuselage, the cameras revealed a pair of the plane's giant pontoons strapped to a wooden pallet on the deck. A blast from the ROV's thrusters dusted a layer of silt and mud off one of the pontoons, exposing a forest green paint scheme on the topsides and a sharp gray tone on the pontoon's belly. A similar camouflage paint pattern would be found on the wings and fuselage. Once past the pontoons, the hangar grew empty for several feet as the ROV passed through a separate open compartment. Like its beagle namesake, Snoopy sniffed along, gingerly examining each silt-covered object or debris item carefully via the touch of Dirk's fingers. A set of low-slung racks gradually grew out of the darkness on either side of the hangar, holding what Dirk immediately recognized as torpedoes. 4 of the metallic fish rested in each rack, aerial torpedoes that at 1,300 pounds each were much smaller than the massive submarine launch torpedoes found below decks. Dirk and Summer stared at the monitor, straining to see evidence of additional armament. But no other weaponry was visible. Dirk turned and noticed Summer peering at her watch, grimly cognizant of each minute that passed. "Let's keep going. There should be at least one more plane in here," Dirk said, trying to keep her mind off the inevitable. The ROV again moved through a vacant compartment before emerging into the next hangar section. Seconds later, the tail and fuselage of a second Ceyron bomber emerged into view, complete with folded wings. Just beyond was its matching pair of floats, strapped to the deck by cables. An assortment of wall-mounted tool bins followed, and then 20 feet of empty space. Snoopy finally bumped up against the giant round hatch door that led to the submarine's forward deck. "Well, that's it," Dirk said solemnly. "We've covered the length of the hangar and no sign of any aerial bombs other than the torpedoes." Summer said nothing for a moment, subconsciously biting her lower lip in dejection. "Well, there was no indication of a forced entry anywhere. Nor did the silt appear to have been disturbed any time recently. Perhaps they were destroyed in the torpedo blast? Could be. There's still a small section of hangar behind us we could take a look at." Dirk quietly steered Snoopy back towards the submersible, reeling in its dangling electronic power cable while it progressed. The cockpit fell silent as brother and sister contemplated their predicament. Dirk silently cursed their bad luck and failure to locate the aerial bombs. As the ROV passed the second plane's fuselage and approached the first plane's set of pontoons, a quizzical look fell over Summer's face. "Dirk, hold it there for a second," she said quietly, focusing on the monitor. "What is it?" he asked, while neutralizing the position of the ROV. "Look at the pontoons. Do you notice anything different?" Dirk studied the monitor for a moment, then shook his head. "The pair at the end of the hangar were cabled directly to the deck," Summer said. "But these two have a platform under each of them." He looked at the images and his brow furrowed. Each of the pontoons sat balanced on a square-shaped platform roughly 2 feet high. Dirk eased the ROV around and alongside the base of one of the pontoons, then positioned it next to the platform. Spinning the ROV around, he applied the thrusters hard for a few seconds to try and blow away the encrusted sediment. He repositioned the ROV, then waited for the resulting cloud of sediment to subside. Peering through the murk, they could clearly see an exposed section of the platform. It was a hardwood crate built from what appeared to be mahogany. Dirk carefully studied the entire platform. "By God, that's got to be it." "Are you sure?" Summer questioned. "Well, I can't say what's inside, but the exterior is the same construction and dimension as the bomb canister crates that I found smashed open on the I-403. Dirk surveyed the crate from all angles, then confirmed that a matching crate was wedged beneath the second pontoon. Summer made a notation on the video files, documenting the exact location in the hangar where the crates were found. Pitt observed that each crate appeared to be held in place by the force of the pontoon, which was securely tied to the hangar deck by a half dozen thick steel cables that crisscrossed the top of each float. "Nice eye, Summer. You get a beer for that catch." "Make mine a bottle of Martin Ray Chardonnay," she replied with a half smile. "I'm just glad we know where they are now. It's going to take someone a little more doing to get these out of here." "Us too, for that matter," Summer replied glumly. The wheels in Dirk's mind were still churning to compute an escape plan as he guided the ROV back towards the submersible. He lost concentration when Snoopy's bright underwater lights approached and shined brilliantly into the submersible's cockpit. Blinded in the glare, he instinctively steered the ROV down towards the hangar deck as he brought it closer to the starfish. But as it approached, the ROV suddenly hung suspended, failing to move the last few feet to its cradle. "Dirk, Snoopy's umbilical is caught on something," Summer noticed, pointing out the bubble window. Dirk followed her guide and could see in the murkiness that the ROV's cable had snagged on some sort of debris lying on the hangar deck, about 20 feet in front of them. "I'm surprised we even made it so far through this obstacle course," he replied. Reversing direction, he backed up the ROV until the cable straightened from its grasp around what looked to be a small engine sitting in a tubular frame 3 feet off the ground. "A gas-powered compressor, I bet," he said, noticing a pair of decayed hoses connected to one end of the motor. "What's with the big handle?" Summer asked, eyeing a large metal rod protruding from one side of the block. A round shovel-type grip was attached to the end. "It has an old mechanical starter. Kind of like pulling the rope on a lawnmower, only pumping the handle cranks the motor over. I saw a Swiss-made compressor on a dive boat once that had the same setup." Dirk stared at the handle for a moment, not moving the ROV. "You're going to bring Snoopy home?" Summer finally asked. "Yes," he replied with a sudden gleam in his eye. "But first, he's going to help get us out of here." On board the Sea Rover, nervous apprehension was creeping over the captain and crew. It had been nearly 90 minutes since they last communicated with the starfish, and Morgan was anxiously preparing to call in an emergency rescue. The Sea Rover was not carrying a backup submersible, or ROV, and the nearest Numa submersible was at least 12 hours away. "Ryan, let's contact the Navy's Deep Submergence Unit. Notify them of our situation and request the ETA on a deep water rescue vehicle," Morgan barked, silently dreading the thought. If Dirk and Summer were in real trouble, he knew they only had a matter of minutes, not hours. Their chances of rescue would be as slim as a dime.